Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Carol Muskie Dukes. Her new book of poems is Sparrow. She is the author of several previous collections of poetry, most notably the recent selected poems An Octave Above Thunder. She's written three novels, Dear Digby, Saving St. Germ, Life After Death, as well as collections of essays, Women in Poetry, and Married to the Ice Pick Killer, A Poet in Hollywood. When we last spoke, she had written a novel called Life After Death, which, in a sense, was written before and in certain ways predictive of the death of her husband, David Dukes. This book is a book of elegies, largely, to that actor, her husband, David Dukes, called Sparrow. And I noticed this is the first book, isn't it, in which you take the name on a book of poetry, Carol Muskie Dukes. Even the selected poems was Carol Muskie.
That's right.
And you'd been publishing novels under Carol Muskie Dukes. What did it involve to become officially Carol Muskie Dukes as a poet?
I think a sense of resignation, ultimately. Two things, actually. I did want to acknowledge, in a way, a change in my the sort of current of my writing. But originally I thought, this was some years ago, I thought it when I began writing novels, I thought, well, I want to distinguish between the poems that I write, the poetry that I write, and the fiction. And so I used Carol Muskie Dukes, you know, sort of coupled my married name, as they put it, to the name that my own name, and I thought that would be very useful. But ultimately, it was a nightmare, as people from the Library of Congress and, you know, people who deal all the time, bookstore owners more regularly would say, you've made a mess of things because you're listed. We go to look up your books. You're listed as Carol Muskie. You're listed Carol Dukes, Carol Muskie Dukes. What have you done? So I started hyphenating the novels, I think, and the whatever else. Sometimes in when I wrote critical reviews and things, I'd hyphenate, and then I just sort of gave up. But somehow, too, after David died, I decided to bring all of them together, all the different Carol Muskies and Carol Dukes and Carol Muskie Dukes under one name and hyphenate it. So, long way to say, it was a choice.
But a choice in a certain way that feels significant to this book.
Yes, to this book in particular, obviously, because these are elegies that, for David and about David, and that he participates in this book, and I don't want to say in a sense authors the book, but really is really involved in a way in the making of the book, in the making of the poems, in a much more proactive way than, I know I'm sound like, you know, a medium or something, in a much more proactive way than one would typically think of the inspiration for poems.
Now, in many ways, his life becomes a source of memory for the poems, mm-hmm. and there are poems named after plays and roles he's been in.
That's correct.
So there's a poem called Waiting, but it's after Waiting for Godot. Mm-hmm. There's a poem called, is it The Importance of Being?
The Importance of Being, right, or The Importance of, then there's one called Not for Burning, or Not for Burning it's called, instead of the entire title, right?
I wanted
to indicate, obviously, fragments.
But they're little stabs of memory that seem to mm-hmm. be origin points
yes.
for thinking about him or thinking about that yes. aspect of him.
Yes, I think that people react to this, to these poems. They've just come out, but they already, as I've been giving readings around, they've reacted them to them in a variety of ways. One way, of course, is autobiographical, the way that I'm, in fact, least interested in the poems being received as, although it's fine, I was less interested in a kind of autobiographical narrative and more interested in that place where language links acting and poetry. Not to be pretentious about it, but, you know, that place where, what did you say, the little stab that's made or the little sort of perforation in the membrane between, which I think is made of language, you know, between those two arts, if there is such a thing, you know, that where they come together, the proactive nature, the transformational nature of language on the page, and then certainly my attempt to try to understand the transformation of an actor in a role on stage.
Well, I thought it would be interesting to begin by hearing the poem called Actor.
Actor, you give me up, you go away, you walk on a stage and are remade. I long for you, but you have a strophic relationship to longing. You move so gracefully between what the author intended, what the audience requires. Perfect messenger, you want nothing. You never wanted more than that enunciatory light on your face, the words learned by heart so that the body could make every human intention inviolable. All is revelation in that world. How could I have ever competed with such implacable possession of gesture? When you crossed under the arc of the proscenium, you were already dead to me, yet more alive than ever. You turned back once to look at me over your shoulder, opening the stage door. Not yet made up, but already a stranger, the hawk staring out of your face.
Now, that's one of the ideas that runs through the book of poems Sparrow by my guest Carol Muskie Dukes, which is published by Random House, that the actor husband taking a role is already leaving, mm-hmm. in some sense, and that that person becomes in a way unreachable while he's in the transformed state.
Yes.
Of a role.
Right. And actors will always talk about, or often talk about, just in a very practical sense, being on stage, they're unreachable. They're completely unreachable. You cannot, even if a terrible tragedy, emergency occurred in their private lives, you could not get them on stage in the moment, you know, in the role, when they're actually on the boards. But yes, extending that to the larger issue of, you know, the departure into the other, right, into whatever character is being created, you know, that takes the place of the self or uses the material of the self, the energy of the self, to become what it is.
In another poem, you mentioned something that Yeats learned from an Indian mystic who believed that if an actor were to die while playing the role of Hamlet, he would arrive in the other world, in heaven, as Hamlet.
Right. I think the quote is something like, if an actor dies playing Hamlet, he will be Hamlet after his death. And Yeats quotes that, and I think it's in Vision. I think it's in Vision. But Yeats' book of Vision, you know, the sort of dissection of the occult. But Yeats believed that, I think. And there is this horrifying sense that we comfort ourselves with always with the notion of an afterlife. But how will we know each other? You mentioned the hymn, right? You know, how will we know each other in the great beyond? But even more so for actors. I mean, what if, you know, Molière died on stage? Well, more or less. I mean, he died just after, you know, being in The Imaginary Invalid. But sorry, it's just too, I mean, you know, it gets mercury-like. We were talking about, you know, this idea of, you know, the trickster. But in a way, this idea of coincidence, as we've talked about before, attends art. But, you know, if an actor were in a role, would the afterlife then, in a sense, judge or categorize or put that person into a heaven or an afterlife in which he is still or she is still in that role? And you wouldn't recognize that person, right? Well, or they wouldn't recognize you either.
There's a kind of visionary improvisation in that poem where you imagine yourself entering heaven,
yes.
and wondering, well, you'll see Hamlet, but would that be satisfactory? Where would David be?
Exactly. Or looking into his eyes, he would still be in the role. There's that aspect of it, too, that you would see him physically in some way or some representation of the physical, this form reproduced, but he would be in the role of Hamlet, so he would not be able to remember or recognize me or anyone. You know, the whole notion, it's so disturbing, isn't it? Because we comfort ourselves with that idea that we and our loved ones will be together, in quotes,
well, that,
in the
that
beyond.
That almost seems like the idea for heaven, and yet there's the hymn that Charles Ives set, whose main line is, will we know one another there?
Yeah.
And that sadness, the idea that
we may not.
May not.
We may not.
And this vision of the actor as disappearing into another self, even a metamorphosed body, is an eerie anticipation of that possibility that we know someone very well. You know, Ophelia's famous, the owl was a butcher's daughter.
The owl's a butcher's daughter, right.
Who knows what we might
be? Who knows? I use that as an epigraph for my novel. That's exactly right. The owl's a butcher's daughter. Right, you know, who knows what we might be?
Now, I'm speaking to Carol Muskie Dukes. You're listening to Bookworm. Her new book of poems is Sparrow. It's published by Random House. It's a series of elegies to David Dukes, her husband, the actor who recently died. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Now, what fascinates me as you go through the book is that at a certain point, David leaves. So we have David, we have his death, as remembered by a phone call. We then have his roles, the roles that he played to remind one of him. And then there is the afterlife, a world in a sense, where all sorts of messages are coming back, perhaps from a David, or exteriorizing feelings about him.
Right.
And there's a very great poem that appeared in The New Yorker that I love. It's called A Private Matter. And it's... What's fascinating is that now we're in the house in which this husband and wife have lived. There are, of course, scripts all around, and anyone who lives in Los Angeles knows there's all this blank paper, which you might cut up and turn into, you know, note papers, and these become almost like a tarot deck, a visitation of possible significance in which Carol is having her mourning, her elegies exteriorized by these slips of paper by the telephone table. The poem is called A Private Matter.
And can I just say one quick thing, too, as
of
we're
course.
Talking about this, you're tracking, of course, you know, the sort of autobiographical narrative of the book, which is very much there, and then talking about what is knowable and what is not knowable, in a sense, the afterlife. I think that my sense in these poems of the author, myself, as we all say, the poet, when we talk, when poets talk about their own work, the poet, the speaker, we say sometimes, but who is speaking, the person speaking here has lost herself, too, in a sense, has become, in a way, not to be melodramatic, but sort of unknown to oneself. I mean, after death, everyone who's gone through this, and we all have and will, you feel sort of cut free from the gravity of identity. So that I think, I hope, the poem also speaks to that. I had been writing a pure elegy, that is to say, an elegy, a remembrance of someone who's died, and I was found myself sort of in this high rhetoric of grief as I wrote, you know, and then I thought in writing this poem, I was sitting in my kitchen, I thought, what would be the least, not the least, but I don't mean to say that at all, but what would be the opposite, in a sense, of the high rhetoric of grief? I mean, what would you take, what kind of language could you pick up that, in a sense, would, you know, just work totally against this rhetoric? And I saw these pieces of screenplay sitting there, and I thought, well, of course it's impossible. You can't incorporate, you know, pieces of screenplay into a poem, but I thought I'd give it a whirl, and that's what...
Well, it's sort of like using the TV set as a Ouija board.
And, of course, you can, right? Yes. I mean, you think about, you know, the Shopping Channel or something is giving you messages. I'm sorry. This is called A Private Matter. You, never you, the new vessel, dark light of the sprung soul, flung upward or shuttered, upringing, iridescent as a fountain, eyes flickering wide open in sleep. And on the kitchen sideboard, backs of script pages, cut up by you to memo size. If someone jots a note, turns it over, there are the words, dialogue of people you once became or not. Laura says she cannot command the space station alone any longer. Can't he see this? Brent says he knows. He knows what she's been going through. I don't know what these words are for. Just as I know, you will arrive no more to counter this argument. You may have said these things aloud. You walked, you lay once beside me. Albert says suddenly, from a paper square. Vague, cryptic, enigmatic, ambiguous. Claude says, how do you mean? I want to enter every semblance of you, profile, ideogram, rain light, zigzag kite, shifting plinth, even this comment from Mohammed. I should be going. This is a private matter. Earlier, Frida has said, you're upsetting me, Ira. Let me consider this private matter in anger, in terror, in reverence. Voiceless, let me consider a thumbprint, a top sheet, margin shout. Here's Mark crying, bullshit. How can a man live in any other time but his own? At the tombstone, the fire pit, at the anchor dragged brain red over consciousness, Ivan says, I don't see why I have to put up with your tantrums. In this private matter, I refuse the lilac, the anemone, all the lit banked candles. Rachel says, he's in the middle of nowhere, without an alibi. Bring me no alibi. Bring me instead one sprig, pale white, of your never-endlessness. One pulse leap inside the sick, brilliant rose of your not being. Holden says, that's my girl. Fire rose, ash, drawn petaled, unpetaled along my wall of solitude. You hover, eyelit, at falcon height, and Surge cries, read Seneca. Laura is alone in the space station, weeping. I am not weeping. I am emptying the pockets of my own monologues. I am listening to the semblances, what you were, who you've been. You're disastrously open-minded, a fragment says, it seems to me, though I ask for no feedback here in my space station, here in my former life, where there is no gravity, or this crushing gravity, in my kitchen, my open mind, where I listen closely to no connections. To you, David, know you.
Carol Muskie Dukes reading A Private Matter from her collection, Sparrow. I think that's an amazing poem.
Well, thank you.
I guess it's because the leap in diction from the beginning to the comedy of these slips of paper, the way they begin as a premise for a poem and then right. become echoing and haunted and a kind of really kind of beautiful and eerie capturing of the comedy of being alone and self-dramatizing, knowing that and yet feeling the penetration of emotion.
Absolutely.
It's really, you know, it's a very, it seems to me, unusual capturing of that self-dramatizing state of address that a poet enters when writing an elegy.
Well, thank you. I have to say that it is entirely self-dramatizing, it's true, but there's a kind of... I think that's exactly why I was working against that rhetoric of grief, because the rhetoric of grief, by definition, has to be self-dramatizing, right? You are left with the self and the absent one, and you are grieving for the person who is not there. It's by nature, right? It becomes almost classically histrionic in a sense. But... yes, the antidote, if you can speak in such terms, to that, in a sense, is the language of the very, interactive, you know, socially outward-moving externalization, as you said, of language, which is the screenplay, the telescript, whatever. And these are actual quotes from, I mean, Laura and the space station is made up, but the rest of them are actual quotes from real screenplays and real, that's funny, from actual screenplays and scripts and so on. And the ending, which actually you helped me with, I don't know if you recall this, but I gave a reading at a bookstore and I wasn't sure yet. I just finished the poem. I wasn't sure. I was just working with The New Yorker, I think, in proofreading. And I had, originally the last line was, when I listen closely to connections, to know you, David, know you. I repeated the know you twice, but then I realized, in terms of what we're just talking about, in terms of the sort of the world of the social, you know, theatrical and the world of the elegy or grief, that it had to be you, the you who was present, and then the no you of the absence.
I'll tell you something.
You helped me with that. You suggested that would work better, as I recall.
I have a subsequent reading of that, though.
Do you?
That's terrifying and I think beautiful. You don't have to accept it.
Okay. I'll listen closely, as the poem says.
But here it is, and maybe it's intended because I hear it, in fact.
Okay.
Now, the listener has to understand that this no is N-O. It's not no as in K-N-O-W, not no you.
Right. That's true, yeah.
The last line is, she is in the kitchen, my open mind, where I listen closely to no connections, to you, David, know you. But suddenly, when I was reading the poem again, I thought, this is a poem in which all these messages are coming from the phone pad from all over, and I heard, to you, David, and a ghostly voice saying, know you.
Oh, meaning coming from...
David.
Right. Say it
almost
again.
As a return of the toast.
It's right, exactly. Oh, so it's coming
where
back.
I listen
I see what
closely
you're saying.
To no connections. To you, David, know you.
Oh, my God. I never even...
Yeah, and suddenly I realized that the poem was an act of invocation and that those last two words can, among other things, be read as the success of an exchanged memory ghost.
And also in terms of the dialogue of the screenplay.
Exactly.
That it ends up, it is a monologue, as it says, or it thinks of it, you know, again, right, the elegy speaking into the void sort of, but this makes it a dialogue.
Right.
Oh, what would I have? I suppose I'd have to, I don't know.
No, don't do anything.
Italicize something. Or
it would have to be no, comma, you, and put it
that's
and
right,
put
no.
in quotes. But
you're right.
No reason to do it, because the point is that it's his ghost there, and it's the ghost of a returned message. And it just, you know, when I read it that way, it just went, oh, my, you know.
Wow. You heard it first. I mean, we're sitting here recreating the poem in a sense as we're talking, we're getting messages, you know. But that's a really interesting reading of that. I like that. It's been a much more positive, well, I hate that word, but, you know, the sense of, like, you know, there being a return, there being an answer, which is really, you know, it's heartening.
Well, I'm
at the end.
I'm the world's optimist, because the poem as written is to the know you, the man who's disappeared not
right.
only into a role but into death, so he's not there.
Right.
There's know you. But how nice Nick and Nora Childs-wise
yes.
to have a return from
a tip of the hat.
The dream that one has that one will hear a final voice someday in exchange to answer the loss.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I feel like this poem is still in flux in a way. It's really interesting because I do feel like it's, you know, it's a poem that's sort of, it has no place, you know, it just keeps moving. It's a very oddly fluid and I don't know how to say it exactly, non-static poem. So this is, you know, if you look at it in this way you're saying it, which is optimistic, it opens out at the end into that possibility as opposed to hammering down the way the elegy inevitably has to, right? You know, here lies my best poem. You know, it's over. You know, it's over. But it's not over. I mean, maybe that's not true. Maybe the elegy always invokes and opens out. But doesn't it also hammer down, and doesn't it also close down
it
possibilities?
It finalizes.
Yes.
And
that's
it makes a monument.
Right. And I'm thinking of, you know, of Auden's elegy for Yeats. You became your readers. You became those who follow you, right? You became the other. So you continue in that way. He says that, right? Openly. And then it, of course, ends with teach the free man how to praise, you know, a great invocation of the heart and the positive.
But it's also, for me, the reason why I like it being a potential double meaning rather than having it enforced by the poem is that it's almost a joke on the level of these pages of screenplay. You know, the thing that a husband and wife parted would say to each other would not be to you, know you. That's a bit of screwball comedy
right.
dialogue. But it's wonderful on the level that coming from
these
bits of
right.
screen and TV dialogue, that is the way ghosts talk on Topper or in Blythe Spirit.
You know,
they're very elegant and they're very reciprocal.
And yeah, you're absolutely right. And one of these is, I think I catch something from a Neil Simon play, as a matter of fact. It's not Noel Coward exactly. But, you know, or maybe there's something from even from Design for a Living in there somewhere. But, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, it goes back to, it keeps referring back to the sort of, the happenstance of the language of screenplay and Della's grip. So,
now, I wanted to ask you, because in the title poem, it's acknowledged that Catullus, mourning his beloved, thinks about her sparrow, which is a tiny thing, and in the original language, can you say the word?
It's pipiabat. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, and it's just a tiny little peeping sound.
It's a little peeping sound. And a Latin scholar actually told me that, and I didn't realize, I didn't catch this in proofreading, that it ended up pipiabat, which is an E instead of an A, but it's supposed to be P-I-P-I-A-B-A-T, which is the Latin for it cheeps, or it's cheeping, or sort of warbling. It has that little piping noise perfectly, pipiabat.
Well, what you admire in that poem is the smallness of that moment.
Thank you.
And its particularity. And there's almost a sense in this book of enormous gesture and small gesture. And I wanted to ask you about the end of mourning, at least as a subject for poetry. Mm-hmm. Can one say, okay, no more David poems, or does it never stop?
Well, I don't know, because I feel like this book is different from other books I've written, so I don't know whether it's changed some focus of mine forever and, you know, my focus preoccupation. I have a feeling, yes, that there is. One doesn't continue to write, you know, I'm no Thomas Hardy, but Hardy wrote, as you know, about his dead wife beautifully for many, 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 many years with great sorrow and regret. So I can imagine other David poems, but I don't think that I actually do hope that, you know, I won't stay focused on just the death itself, that there will be ways and, you know, that he will, again, to use these ghostly terminologies, but he will return perhaps in a different form. Catullus was remarkable, as you know, because he was such an irreverent poet, and one would expect him to be making fun of the sparrow, but in fact, he appreciated this tiny, as you put it, object disappearing down, as he puts it, the dark alleyway of the infinite. I'd like to continue down that alleyway without being mugged, of course.
I've been talking with Carol Muskie-Dukes, author most recently of Sparrow, published by Random House. Thank you, Carol, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can read the first poem in Sparrow on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistants from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.